William, did you get a sheet, William? Venerable? Oh, William, come. Just help. You don't have to have it. Just something that may help understanding what we said. So let's begin with the motivation prayer that Rabbi Shea has used and that we used all the time in all the different teachings. Short prayer that is the taking of Mahayana refuge and generating bodhicitta. Try to think of the meaning also. We'll say once in English, then in Tibetan, and then English once again. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. Due to the merits of listening to the teaching and so forth, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all migrating beings. Sangye chudang soki chognam la changchu badu dagni kapsu chi dagi chushe gipe sognam ki drola penju sangye drupa shu. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. Due to the merits of listening to the teachings and so forth, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all migrating beings. So try to meditate as you see Rinpoche's sincere, seriousness at the beginning of the teaching, concentrating on the meaning of the motivation. Let's try to spend a few moments in meditation thinking of the meaning of that prayer, taking refuge to distinguish us from our non-Buddhist inclinations and generating the mind of bodhicitta to separate our mind from just thinking of, if we could even, thinking of liberation for ourself alone. My past mothers, sentient beings, are suffering in so many diverse ways with such intensity for such duration that I must find a means to separate them from that suffering. So however long it takes, I must purify my Buddha potential, the potential that's on my mind stream, getting rid of the temporary, the adventitious stains in my mind, developing within that clear light nature of my mind all of the qualities and the activities of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, eventually the Buddhas, to quickly attain the state, no matter how long it takes, the state of Buddhahood, in order to lead them perfectly, skillfully, like Kriti Sanjab Rinpoche, like His Holiness, like Lama Sopa Rinpoche, out of suffering into that enlightened state. Thank you very much. I used to carry some cough drops. I think you're out of luck. Does anyone have a cough drop for Sister Emily? I mean, soothe her. Yeah. Whatever that will soothe her. Pamela undoubtedly has in this. You know, Atisha had this. Asanga, rather, it was always pictured having this huge kind of basket that he carried with him. I didn't know it was. Asanga always has the stupa next to him, and Asanga had this little basket. So I think Pamela, in her future, she will be pictured with this bag from India. The Venerable Pamela, you have some cough drops, probably antibiotics and other things. If you need an injection or a saline solution, I think somewhere down in the bottom of that she has. Also, could you pass that on to? Okay. So, this is we've been studying the text of Maitreya, one of the five texts of Maitreya, called the Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra, the treatise of the great vehicle, sublime continuum. And maybe I'll just leave, first of all, maybe right from the beginning, first of all, see if there's any questions, and then we can kind of go over, review what Rinpoche has mentioned this week, and see if we can clear up if you have any questions or doubts. But see if... I'll leave some time for questions at the beginning and then at the end, but you can always interrupt as we're going along. Anyone have anything residual? Karen. In what context was Rinpoche talking about this?
He was talking about bodhisattva and maybe the three purposes. Just before
it was right after he gave that quote about having my mind become a dharma and the dharma become a path, mm-hmm. the path of obstacles, and he was talking about renunciation and then talking about bodhisattva.
Yeah.
He gave those three, but I only got two also.
Yeah. I'm going to
I
have two qualities. Quality of the reading. I wasn't sure. Right before you started, was
the text itself, or it was part of the sort of preamble?
I didn't put. I put notes on my sheet without putting them in order, so I can't. I can't find exactly. It doesn't. I'm not sure exactly. Several things.
Okay, where the well-being of sentient and the power to cut through the root of samsara, the ignorant self, the whole thing itself. Yeah. And so, I have a question.
Maybe you could start again because someone was talking when you said that. I didn't catch what exactly the first thing was that you said.
Concerned with the well-being of sentient beings. That was the first.
Then?
Then I may have missed the second, people are saying. And then the power to cut through the root of samsara, ignorance grasping itself.
I'm not sure, but Rinpoche may have been talking either about the three principles of the path. Is it possible? Or?
Thinks of others brings one to enlightenment. I don't know, but I have a question mark by that too. The whole three things.
Then I have desire for liberation of that and going on without problem.
Usually, when we talk about, there are various presentations that summarize all of the essential ingredients of the path. One, of course, is, as Lama Tsongkhapa mentioned, the three principles of the path. So, stainless renunciation, which is desiring to escape from cyclic existence. Then, the altruistic intention to achieve enlightenment in order to, out of compassion for sentient beings, in order to liberate them from suffering. Those two are, in a sense methods, right? Renunciation and bodhicitta. And the wisdom that is necessary to act along with them to bring either of those goals, either liberation or enlightenment, is the wisdom that realizes emptiness of egolessness that could have been what Rinpoche was talking about. Sometime in we can check on the recording later. I don't recall that particular point, as that was in the preamble.
Mm-hmm. About your question, I wasn't clear on it. Can you clarify?
Well, I asked two questions, so which one?
We were using Tibetan vocabulary too, right, when we were talking to him. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if you understood.
If I understood what I was talking about?
I have no idea
what I was saying.
What they answered, and if you could tell us what they answered.
Well, which question are you talking about? Because I asked two questions.
I'm talking about your question. I don't think I got a whole lot of it.
It's becoming the cause of the rupa kaya. That complicated one. Not the Arya's past one, but the coming one.
When you were quoting your previous study and asking about something, I was very interested, but I couldn't do it.
Right. Well, I think that was the second question. But anyway, well, just to mention that, maybe the other one will come up later. There are two aspects of Buddha lineage. Right, there are various words that are almost synonymous. Sometimes they may not, some of the words may not be exact synonyms, but they more or less indicate the same thing. Sometimes we say Buddha nature, but there's no word exactly that I can find in the scriptures that reflect that word Buddha nature, but sometimes even books are called that, right? There's a word Buddha lineage, Sangegi Rik. There's the word that comes in the root text right at the beginning, potential. And so we can call that Buddha potential. The word in Tibetan, nupa, which also means the power that Buddha has to do things. So potential or power. There's the word tathagata garba. Have you heard that expression? I think we mentioned this last time. Tathagata garba. You know what? We mentioned about this last time. Remember what I asked someone what the Tathagata was? Someone that is an epithet of the Buddha, someone who has gone to thusness, who's reached a realization of ultimate nature, perfect understanding of how things are. So Tathagata garba. There's another word, calm. And that is translated as sometimes as inclination, or could be translated just as element. So all of those words are kind of indicating a feature that we have. And here in the text, the main thing that's being talked about in this first chapter is one of these. This is one of the seven Vajra points, right? Vajra-like points. The first three are Buddha Dharma and the assembly. And the fourth one is this potential that could be called Tathagata Garba, or inclination, or Buddha lineage. So what it's referring to, there are two kinds. One of them, it refers to what's called the naturally abiding lineage, which is the actual emptiness of the mind of sentient beings like ourselves that are still stained with defilements. That's called the Tathagata Garba, or the potential. And remember I asked you last time There's always some debate about this. I asked you last time, did the Buddha have Buddha potential? And we were explaining how in this tradition, it's said that by the definition of potential, the Buddha doesn't have this potential any longer because it only refers to the emptiness of the defiled mind. You know, anywhere on that continuum up until the state of enlightenment. Remember what the emptiness of the Buddha's mind is called? Do you remember, Dorje? Yes. Or in Tibetan they say Ngong Niku, the entity, body of entityness, or the maybe sometimes they even call it the nature body. So it refers to the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. Ngong Niku. So I may have mentioned last time the Dharmakaya. Usually, sometimes we define Buddhahood as two aspects. The form body, Rupakaya, and the phenomenal body, or you could call it the mental body, the Dharmakaya, right? Actually, the Dharmakaya is not exactly the mental body. Part of it's the mental body. If you talk about mental meaning mind, because the Dharmakaya has these two parts, one of which is this nature body, the emptiness of the mind, and the other is just the Buddha's wisdom Dharmakaya, the actual conventional mind of the Buddha, as far as I understand. Yeah.
Pat? So, is it on the Dharmakaya, is it the relative, is the mind?
Yeah, it's called the wisdom Dharmakaya. So in Tibetan we say Yeshe Choku, like Lama Yeshe. Yeshe means kind of gnosis or exalted wisdom. In Sanskrit they say Jnana or Jnana Dharmakaya. So that's the omniscient mind.
And then the ultimate Dharmakaya, is that the same as the emptiness of the Buddha's mind?
So there's not an official, I don't know if the word ultimate came in that context, but if you were to say, what is the ultimate nature of the Buddha's mind? It would be that nature body, the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. And the conventional nature of the Buddha's mind is what's referred to as the wisdom Dharmakaya. So I had mentioned that usually it's said that potential in our mind, the Buddha potential, the Buddha lineage, in our mind, at the time of Buddha, becomes the nature body, the svabhavikakaya, the ngong niku, right? Because on the continuum of our consciousness, when we become Buddha, the emptiness of our mind stream, once we've become Buddha, is no longer called Buddha potential, as it is now. The emptiness of our mind stream then would be called the nature body. So there's kind of like a continuity of that, of the basis is different. The emptiness, of course, is in the sphere of emptiness is the same, but still it has a different name. The emptiness of the enlightened bodies, enlightened beings' mind stream is called the nature body. So that was one of the things I was saying. But in some teachings that Rinpoche gave in Bodh Gaya some years ago, he said that the other lineage, the developmental lineage, because there are two lineages, the natural abiding lineage, which is the emptiness of our mind, and that eventually becomes the emptiness of the Buddha's mind at the time of enlightenment, right? So there's another kind of potential called the developmental potential, which is kind of like, is talking about a relative nature of our mind. The naturally abiding lineage, that kind of Buddha potential is referring to the emptiness of our mind, but there's another quality of our mind which allows for our mind to develop virtuous qualities and to eliminate, has the potential to eliminate negative aspects from our mind, and that is called variously the developmental lineage. So lineage or potential has those two kinds of aspects. The naturally abiding lineage is the emptiness of our mind. The developmental lineage is something which is a conventional quality of our mind. And Rinpoche had said in Bodh Gaya some years ago, if the translation had been correct, if the transcript of the translation had been correct, because I have the transcript, he's said to have said that the developmental lineage at the time of enlightenment becomes the form body of Buddha. So I was a bit perplexed by that, because I had, in other contexts, it says that the developmental lineage, which is kind of like the clear, conventional clear light nature of our mind. You know, sometimes clear light nature, when we studied in Lohrig, when we talk about Selsching Rigpa, that which is clear and knowing, it has many different meanings. Clarity, the clear light nature of our mind. Sometimes on the level of sutra, it just means the nature of the body, of the mind, our mind, conventional nature, as not being obstructing or obstructive to thought. That the mind can develop virtuous qualities. It's not stuck in any one negative state, and so forth. So in some other teachings, even in Uttara Tantra, at other points it says that the developmental lineage becomes the conventional nature of the Buddha's mind. Right? Because the Buddha's mind has two natures. It has a conventional nature and ultimate nature. What becomes the ultimate nature of the Buddha's mind? Someone? The naturally abiding lineage, right? The emptiness of our mind becomes the ultimate nature, the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. So what becomes the conventional nature of the Buddha's mind, or becomes the wisdom Dharmakaya, is sometimes said to be that naturally abiding lineage of our mind. Obviously, the defilements of our mind don't become the Buddha's omniscient mind. They are eliminated and abandoned over time. But in the teachings in India some years ago, it seemed that Rinpoche said that naturally abiding lineage became the Rupakaya, the form body of Buddha. And when I asked that, Rinpoche said he saw no contradiction, because according to Tantra, there is not the same kind of contradiction between form and consciousness that we find in the sutra vehicle. If something is consciousness, it's not form in the sutra vehicle, right? Do you know what I'm saying? But a Buddha's mind, Buddha's experience, when you talk about the Buddha's body as being a purified form, a purified variety of his energy current, his wind, his prana or lung, and his mind, and that wind are inseparable. His body and that mind are inseparable. They're of the same nature, but still conceptually distinguishable. The Buddha's body and the Buddha's mind. Wherever the Buddha's mind is, the Buddha's body is also there. So if we were to say that this is one of the reasons why in the Lam Rim teachings or in the Sutra teachings we say, oftentimes we invoke the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in order to make offerings or to consecrate a statue or a stupa or something. It's said in the teachings it's not really necessary in a sense, because the omniscient mind being omnipresent, also the Buddha's body is omnipresent, because the two of them are inseparable. So I think this is what Kirti Sanchar Rinpoche was getting at when I said, how is it that the developmental lineage seemed to have been set at that time to transform into the Rupakaya, the Buddha's body, whereas at other places it said that developmental lineage becomes the wisdom Dharmakaya. And he was saying that in a sense there's no contradiction, because according to Tantra they're ultimately inseparable. So if something became the conventional nature of the Buddha's mind, it would also in a sense partake of the conventional nature of the Buddha's body.
We just trying to label, when we put the word body on it, we really don't necessarily think of it like a body.
Well, he was talking about the word, Tibetan word ku, you know, Like we say tulku, you know the word tulku? That's a reincarnation. Or chuku. What is chuku? Dharmakaya, right? Ku in Tibetan is the honorific for, can be body. Like ordinary word for our body is lu. Lu. Like L-U-S, where the S makes the sa at the end, makes the vowel sound short. Lu. The honorific of body, you would talk about, like when we say to someone higher than ourselves or out of respect, we say, kusu debu in pe. How is your form body, your ku, your kusuk, your form body? Is it well? Something like that. Is it well? And so this word ku is the, in Sanskrit, is the word kaya. But kaya doesn't only mean body, it means collection. And so Rinpoche was mentioning how sometimes it comes up in the teachings, because sometimes people think a kaya, like the Dharmakaya, has to be some kind of physical. We think of body as meaning something comprised, well, even if not physical, comprised of particles or composed. Whereas he said also there are some bodies of the Buddha, some ku or kaya, like the Svavavikakaya, which are not composed of anything because they're uncompounded. They're the ultimate nature of the Buddha's mind. So I think that's what he was referring to in that context. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you?
When he was speaking in Bodhgaya, was explaining this point according to Tantra? Because, what you heard at that point must have been according to... Because I thought they tried really clearly to separate sort of Sutra and Tantra in terms of philosophy for points like that.
In some cases, that's true. I'm not sure if I mentioned last time, but it's one of Lama Tsongkhapa's own experiences and something that's given in the teachings, that the study of Tantra helped Lama Tsongkhapa understand certain very difficult points of sutra, of the sutra path, that were sort of difficult to come to grips with, sort of to come to some deciding decision about. And likewise, there were certain things he said in Tantra that he was able to come to a finer understanding of through his understanding of sutra. So it's within that context, often when we talk about let's say what happens at death. In the sutra system, it doesn't talk about so much, what happens in it may talk about a bardo body, but it doesn't talk about the same way that the tantra system talks about the bardo body's principal cause is the subtle wind, and the cooperative cause is the subtle mind. And the bardo body being's mind, the principal cause of that, substantial cause of that, is the subtle mind, and the cooperative cause of that is the subtle wind. It doesn't talk about it, but by understanding that from Tantra, then you can kind of understand more the sutra presentation, that it's not in conflict with that. In general, sometimes it's said it's not good to mix terminology, but they're different. This is a situation, I think, that as Rinpoche actually went into some discussion of these things, this is not a situation where there's a great conflict. There's something that can help you to understand, because it's something, His Holiness also, when he's given discourse on the Uttara Tantra, which is studied in all the Tibetan traditions, and I'm not sure if it's studied much in Japan or in other Mahayana countries, but in the other Tibetan traditions, there's a lot of interpretation that's also drawn from the tantric tradition when you talk about clear light nature and so forth. So that was one of the questions that I was asking at that time. That was,
If you weren't looking from a tantric perspective, then what would be the source of the Rupakaya according to Sutra, if it wasn't this developing?
Well,
could you repeat the question?
She said, if you weren't talking about it from the point of view of Tantra, what would be the source, or I presume you mean the substantial cause of the Rupakaya, when you achieve enlightenment, the form body. So usually it's said that the cause of the rupakaya is the collection of merit. We say sonam gisok. The two collections that we have to accumulate. One is a collection of merit, virtuous karma, which you collect on the conventional level. So all the merit that we usually collect is of that variety, and it is that collection of merit which is a bodhisattva has within their continuum, you know, has collected, that becomes the cause of the rupakaya, according to, in general, according to Sutra and Tantra, I think both, in one level.
I think I'm missing something because, I guess in my mind, I was thinking of conventional qualities as being that merit. So what's the distinction? What is the difference between the conventional qualities and the merit in the mental continuum?
Which conventional qualities are you talking about?
In the developmental lineage, the cause is...
The developmental lineage is not talking about the virtuous karma that we've created. It's talking about a quality of the mind that allows it to be separated from delusions. Now, if you think about it, just the emptiness of the mind, everything has as its ultimate nature emptiness. But not everything can become Buddha. This cup can't become Buddha. Just because something is empty doesn't mean that it can become Buddha, but it can change. Our mind, and also, this whole subject is very, very profound. I find very profound. The developmental lineage is not talking about just our collection of merit. It's not talking about that at all. It's talking about a quality, a conventional quality of the mind that allows the mind to be separated from delusions and allows, every mind has the capacity to generate all good qualities. Of course, the causes of generating those good qualities, the conventional qualities are the collection of merit, and the cause of creating the Buddha's mind, the wisdom realizing emptiness, and the Buddha's omniscient mind is the collection of wisdom, the meditation on emptiness. So there's two kinds of collections. That's why in the prayer that we say at the beginning, Sangye Chodang Suti Chognam La, Jangshu Bardu Dagni Kapsuchi. In general, we say Dagi Jinsok, which means by my gipe, by generosity and so forth, referring to the six perfections. Sonam Ki, Sonam just means merit, by the merit of creating generosity and so forth. His Holiness has said, Lama Tsopa Rinpoche related this summer, that His Holiness has said more skillful to say, or there's he felt there was very useful to say, instead of sonam, to say sog nam ki. Sog meaning collections, nam meaning plural, instead of sonam is just a word that means merit. Sognam instead of sonam. Sognam means by the collections of giving, making charity, and so forth. So that makes it clear to the person's mind if they're actually thinking about the meaning of that, because there's two collections. Collection of merit, which brings about the rupakaya, our ability to emanate for the welfare of others. So it's obviously connected with the wind element and so forth, the body that appears to sentient beings. And the other collection is called the collection of wisdom, or the collection of exalted wisdom, this yeshe gisok. Sok means collection. So by the collections, in that prayer we say, as Holiness suggested, it's skillful to say, by the collections of making charity and so forth. And the charity, of course, you create, in general, by charity you create a collection of what? Merit or wisdom. In theory, if you just talk about charity, but all of the six perfections are the bodhisattvas are trained to practice in unison. So you have to practice the morality of generosity, charity, the patience of charity, the enthusiastic perseverance of charity, the concentration of charity, but the wisdom of charity. So each of the six perfections has to be conjoined with wisdom. That's why when we dedicate the merit at the end of the sessions, often we say, try to dedicate the merit within the emptiness of the three spheres. This is like the bodhisattva's joining of wisdom with all of the actions. In terms of charity, it would mean, you know, this thing I'm going to give, to recognize it's not truly existent, and that the recipient is not truly existent, and that the act of giving is not truly existent. So to recognize the emptiness of the three spheres, which three spheres? So in the sutra, in general sutra, we don't talk about the substantial cause so much of the rupakaya being the wind, although in tantra you can kind of see this wind takes on the energy current, that is the subtlemost energy current of the Buddha's mind, takes on its ability from the collection of merit, because it is a conventional phenomena and it comes about from the collection of conventional virtuous karma. And the Buddha's mind, which is still of the same nature of that, but of a different kind of, is conceptually distinct, it takes as its principal cause, from the sutra point of view, the collection of wisdom. And the collection of wisdom doesn't mean just the wisdom we have now, you know, you became smart in school, I heard in a movie recently, some lady was bragging, she came in, I came in top two-thirds of my sixth grade class. Something like, well, yeah. The top two-thirds. Not that kind of wisdom. The wisdom that brings about the Buddha's mind is the wisdom realizing emptiness. So from one side, from the sutra side, it's talking about those two collections becoming are the causes of the two bodies. And in tantra, that's not contradicted, but there's also talking about the wisdom, the continuity of our mind, the clear light nature of our mind becoming the Buddha's mind, and the continuity of our wind becoming the rupakaya. So there's some discussions like that. So let's go a little bit through what Rinpoche mentioned the last 2 days, and then there may be some more questions percolating up. I'm not sure I even answered or tried to answer. I'm sure I tried to answer, but I'm not sure I answered what you're saying. So certainly we were just on the first page, how the seven vajra-like categories are taught in sutra. Rinpoche mentioned, and this is what he spent a lot of time on yesterday, that these are taught in a particular sutra that was requested by a king called Dharani Ishvara. I'm not sure why the translator, Jhumpa Yignen, who's a good friend of mine, why he translated King Ishvara. Actually, the text, the Uttara Tantra text actually says, in this point it says King Dharani. His name was Dharani Ishvara, but it actually says Dharani here. So in this particular sutra, which is called the sutra requested by him, Dharani Ishvara, in the introduction to that, there are certain passages that indicate the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is what Rinpoche was saying. And then later in the text, when it's talking about the qualities of the intelligent ones, this is a term that's found a lot in the sutras. You know the Tibetan word lodro? Have you ever heard that name? People call it lodro. Lodro is a word that means can mean intelligence, or can mean, in a sense, intelligent. When it's talking about loden, almost you could translate it, denpa can mean having. Almost it sounds like those who have awareness or those who have mind. But what it means is Lodro Dangdenpa means those who possess intelligence. And that's why in parentheses it says bodhisattvas here, because it's talking about, in the sutras, often the bodhisattvas are referred to as intelligent ones. And those who are, have some sense. You know, not like us. I mean, like me. I don't know about you. So in the chapter, in various categories that in that sutra that we're explaining about the practices of the bodhisattvas, which here in this text is called those with intelligence, and in talking about the qualities of the conquerors, meaning the qualities of the Buddhas, the dharmas of the conquerors, the other four remaining vajra-like points are talked about. So what are the other four like? Four vajra-like points? First is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There's potential, enlightenment, the qualities of enlightenment, and the activities. Yeah. So those are called seven vajra-like points. So Rinpoche spent a little time about clarifying that. And yeah. So then there's a paragraph talking about the order, but I don't think Rinpoche actually even got that far. You might think, at this rate, it would take several years to study this text, right? Rinpoche has already mentioned that he is not going to get even to potential, which is after the Buddha Dharma Sangha in this first chapter. So if we were to try to continue the study of this, we'll have to do that on our own. But he's leaving some instincts. I think some of the, you know, his own great practice, you know, his own great insight shows through in his, you know, his erudition and his not rushing through any of these points. So what he talked about then, the remainder of the second class, and we'll go back to some of the things he said before, we're talking about the various classifications of the bodhisattvas. So he said in that chapter, there are talked about 60 kinds of practices of the bodhisattvas. And so what I've done is I'm not sure, did all of you get a copy of this sheet? Okay. So if you could pass out, I only have a couple more. Pamela, could you pass this back over? Okay, you have one over there. Is someone else missing? Okay. Pamela, you have to be more. And so what I did is I just translated that section from the commentary of Lama Tsongkhapa's disciple, Gyaltsepche. Do you know who I've mentioned this before. You know the two disciples of Lama Tsongkhapa, right? You know who the two disciples are? They were called, Kelsup Dharma Rinchen and Kedrup Palsangbo, Gelik Palsangbo. So sometimes we just call Gelsup J and Kedrup J. Gelsup J is the one who looks a little bit older and peaceful. He's supposed to be, in a sense, kind of an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. And he's often sitting on Lama Tsongkhapa's right, on Lama Tsongkhapa's right side. So when you look at the tanka or statues on the left, as you're looking at them, has a little grayer hair, sort of looking very peaceful. The other side, looks a little more youthful with eyes sort of bulging. You know that statue? It sometimes has a hand in the mudra, tantric mudra of threatening, is Kedrup J. And Kedrup J was the one who was sort of the great, wrote much more about Tantra. He's considered, in a sense, to be kind of like an emanation of Vajrapani. And Lama Tsongkhapa, in a sense, is being body emanation of Manjushri. So the three of them, the three disciples, we say Jay Yabse Sum. Have you heard that expression? Jay, the Lord. Yab means father. Se means sons, Sun means three. So the venerable, or the Lord Father and his sons, the three. That it doesn't mean they're three sons, spiritual sons. It doesn't mean that Gelsup J and Kedrup J were his children, but it is spiritual sons. So their collected works in the Gelugpa tradition are considered to be kind of like the most authoritative text wherever you would study. So Gelsup J. wrote a commentary, which were basically that's what Rinpoche is using to talk about the Uttara Tantra, Gelsup J.'s commentary. And so what I did was I translated from that this section. So maybe just take a look at this a little bit. Rinpoche mentioned these yesterday, and again, we'll go back over some of the other things he said in the previous days, because there's still some to say what little he said about some comments he made about the other things. In that text, in this outline, which is identifying the dharmas or practices that totally purify, so there's a question, what are the 60 types of totally purifying qualities that totally purify the Buddha potential? How can that be? Well, here, I have a question myself. I ask you, what do you think, Victoria? If the Buddha potential is the emptiness of the mind, how can you purify that? What does it mean to purify our Buddha potential? Because that comes up often in this text and other things. We have to purify our Buddha potential. Already pure, is it like empty? How can you change it?
Well, I thought Rinpoche's analogy of the gemstone was extremely skillful. Actually, it really made me understand that it's something that needs to be uncovered. And he said not just taking away the grosser parts, but also to smooth the surface and then to polish it so you really can see the shining Buddha nature. But although I know that I have Buddha nature, I don't actually experience that. And I have my delusions coming up. So that was my understanding of what you were saying about purifying, to discover your Buddha nature.
Yeah. But in one sense, are we purifying just the developmental nature, or are we purifying the naturally abiding nature of our mind? What do you think, Frank? It's Frank, right?
Yeah, Frank.
So I can see him in the camera now.
I think you're purifying both.
How can you purify the naturally abiding lineage?
Well, it's still covered with obscurations, right? Subtle stains that prevent its nature from being...
Right, so in some sense, it looks like that's what's being meant here, because if you just look at it at one level, you might say, well, how could you purify emptiness? It already is pure, and that's its nature. That's what's being referred to. But purifying the Buddha nature in one sense means there's sort of an interrelationship, I think, between these two natures, the developmental lineage and the naturally abiding lineage. So in a sense, by purifying the base of our mind, of adventitious stains, our conventional mind, we are purifying the basis of our mind so that at the time of enlightenment, that mind will, that emptiness will be called svavavikakaya. Right now, the emptiness of our mind is not called nature body, right? It's not called ngon niku. It's called Buddha potential, the emptiness of our mind. Or you could just call it the emptiness of our mind, the ultimate nature of our mind. At the time of enlightenment, that emptiness is called something different, because the basis of the mind, not only is the mind not only is naturally free of inherent existence as it is now, but it is said to be free of two kinds of impurities. It's also totally pure, totally free of all the adventitious stains. Do you know what that means, adventitious? Maybe that's not the best word to translate into English. Lobur in Tibetan, that's how some of the translators have translated for years. Do you know what that means, Venmo?
Lobur? I think it just means something that's not in the nature of the thing itself, like something kind of on top of it that's not the essence of
something. Adventitious, I think if you look in the dictionary, also has the sense, I think you're right, also has the sense of something that can arise because of exterior conditions in some circumstances and then disappear. So adventitious defilements refer to our delusions and the imprints in our mind that, as Venerable Tongni is saying, are not the very nature of our mind. So by purifying those adventitious stains, we're purifying the nature of our mind, and we're purifying the basis upon the basis upon which we are considering the ultimate nature. So at the time of enlightenment, our mind becomes the Svabhavikakaya. So we're purifying our Buddha nature. Another meaning of purifying our Buddha nature is that by meditating on the naturally abiding, how do we purify the adventitious stance? By recognizing the naturally abiding lineage. By meditating on that, what's the naturally abiding lineage? The emptiness of the mind, right? By meditating on that, that it's by that means that we primarily eliminate the adventitious stains. But as Rinpoche mentioned yesterday, also in conjunction with bodhicitta, because you can't eliminate all the stains from the mind with the understanding of emptiness alone, right? You know that, right, Venerable? Why not? What can you eliminate through the realization of emptiness?
The first level of obscurations are called what? you can eliminate pretty subtle ones. What if you know the terminology? Say, for instance, if you were to talk to a
Tibetan or a scholar or a pundit. No, I don't mean in Tibetan, but like say even in English, even in, where are you from? England? Yeah, even in British. We talk about the two kinds of obstructions in our mind. They're called the afflicted obstructions or the deluded obstructions. The word klesha avarana, or the coverings of klesha. You know what klesha, have you heard that word before, klesha? It's a word that we sometimes translate as delusion or maybe sometimes as affliction. It refers to the various disturbing emotions in our mind. And their seeds, even the klesha avarana, the deluded or afflicted obscurations, includes not only purifying the delusions from our mind, but even their seeds, the tendency, the seed that would allow them to arise in our mind again. And that's the word that's used in Tibetan for that kind of imprint is called sabon. Then there's a subtler kind of, the seeds are subtler than the delusions because the seeds are present even when the delusions are not manifest, right? We still have seeds. Even if you're not angry right now, you have seeds of anger in your mind that can give rise to them, give rise to anger when some other situation, you know, if someone were to steal your Mercedes-Benz or... Do you have a Mercedes-Benz? No. If someone were to do something that, you know, that would anger you, then because of having the seed of delusion in your mind, that could rise. Even if you've eliminated the seeds, there can still be other stains in the mind, still obstructions in the mind. Who has eliminated the deluded obstructions? What kind of beings? Do you know that? Arhats, those who have achieved nirvana, have eliminated those stains. Also, certain bodhisattvas on the high levels have also eliminated all of those deluded obscurations. Those are also synonymous with, they're sometimes also called deluded obscurations, are also called the obscurations to liberation. In order to achieve nirvana or liberation, you have to get rid of those. But to achieve omniscience, it's not enough to get rid of those. There is a subtler kind of obstruction called the obstructions to omniscience or to all knowing. Are you with me, Venerable? Have you heard before? So those are called the knowledge obscurations, could be called, you know, or the obscurations to omniscience. The shedip, Tibetan, we say shedip, sheja. Dripa, I guess, is one more elaborate form. So the obscurations to all objects, to knowing all objects of knowledge. So in order to get rid of the delusions, it's sufficient to have the wisdom that realizes emptiness. But to get rid of these other subtler obstructions on our mind, the obstructions to omniscience, it's not enough just to have bodhicitta, but you have to have a union of bodhicitta with the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Kind of like, maybe like water and what? Brillo, or no, what's it called? That's green stuff. Comet, there you go. And, or Ajax, I don't know. You know what I'm talking about? Mr. Clean, I don't know, whatever it is. So, to get out the deep stains that Rinpoche was referring to in the analogy about the, say for instance, if you were to have a vessel filled with garlic or camphor or something else, you'd empty all of that out and clean it out with a cloth, but you could still smell the imprint of that in there. In order to get that out, you have to cleanse more deeply. And in order to cleanse, to get rid of those obstructions to omniscience, you have to have a union of this altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment, along with the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Just bodhicitta alone, you can't eliminate either obstruction. But just the wisdom of emptiness alone, conjoined with renunciation, you could eliminate at least the obstructions to liberation. You could achieve arhatship, but you couldn't achieve Buddhahood. There's still some subtler obscurations. So this is asking, what is the training? What kind of purifying agencies or practices does one use to purify the Buddha potential or this Buddha inclination? So it says ditate in Tibetan. It's sort of like a little bit like tayata. You know, it is like this. So there are four things that were mentioned. There are the four ornaments of the bodhisattvas. Do you remember Rinpoche mentioned that? The eight illuminations of the bodhisattvas, the 16 types of great compassion of the bodhisattvas, and although he didn't mention them, he might mention them the next time, the 32 types of bodhisattva action. So at least they're down on paper. So if they are mentioned in the next class, you'll be able to either correct if I've made some translation error there, or at least say, have a little idea of what's being talked about. So the four ornaments of the bodhisattvas in the commentary says, beautifying when practicing the bodhisattvas' activities, which beautify, which make the adorn or beautify the bodhisattva. And those are, the first three are the three trainings in morality, concentration, and wisdom. And the fourth one, the fourth ornament, is retention, which Vola had said at the time, Rinpoche, I guess, had said, refers to not forgetting the practices, not forgetting the teachings, keeping them in mind. Retention. So do you know what these three trainings are? I don't know, some of the folks back there. What, the gentleman in the salmon shirt, what's your name?
John.
Hi, John. Do you know what the three trainings are?
No.
Baseball, tennis. No, of course they're written here. They're referred to the three trainings that are necessary to, first of all, to achieve liberation. Even when we talk about the Hinayana path, there's said to be three trainings that have to be undergone. In fact, they're usually called the three higher trainings because they're called higher trainings when they're conjoined with. With what? Do you know, Don? As opposed to three trainings. No, they're called the three higher trainings when they're conjoined with renunciation. So just practicing morality or concentration or wisdom as we do, without real pure renunciation, they're not called higher trainings. They're just called trainings. You know, we're training in this, we're practicing this. They're called higher training because it can actually bring about the aim of those trainings that Buddha taught. So the reason that these trainings are mentioned because all of Buddha's teachings are basically, could be all included, all the practices can be included in that. Not only the Hinayana practices, but the Bodhisattva practices can be included in the training of morality, concentration, and wisdom. So generally we say, morality is like the basis of all of the practices because by practicing morality you can ensure a continuity of human lifetimes, this basis to be able to practice, which Rinpoche so beautifully and eloquently it was explaining. We shouldn't take as our motivation, say in listening to the teachings or practicing this, simply to have human rebirth in the future. That's like the aim of the practitioner of lowest scope, right? But we can still aim for that kind of rebirth by practicing morality, because we need to have a continuity of rebirth to practice the bodhisattva path. So if our aim is enlightenment, we still have to try to ensure a practice, a continuity of lifetimes as a human, because it's virtually impossible to practice if one falls into the lower realms. So morality has various functions. One, to ensure a continuity of human rebirths, so that we can practice. Also, it acts to calm the mind from distraction and acts as a basis for the next training of concentration. You can imagine if your mind is upset and immoral, easily swayed by emotions and not watching your actions of body and speech, it'd be very difficult, if not impossible, to generate concentration. That's why in all of the different traditions, when people go into meditation retreat, they try to take ordination of some kind, either the vows of a lay person or the vows of a monk or nun, because that acts as a very good foundation for concentration, which is one of the things one's going to try to do, develop in the retreat. Concentration, sometimes in the example of cutting down a tree, which is like cutting our delusions, the the strength of the axe person, I would say axeman, the lumberjack or Jane, the strength of them is like the practice of morality. The ability to hit the tree in the same spot is like what? Concentration. And the sharpness of the blade, other than hitting it with some dull thing and you never get the tree over, is like the practice of training of wisdom. So the third training is based on concentration. Even if you try to develop some wisdom through understanding, developing your intellect and understanding the meaning of emptiness, unless you have concentration, it's just a fleeting sort of, emptiness. Oh yeah, there it's gone. You know, it doesn't leave any strong imprint or ability to eliminate those faults from your mind. So we need to have the three of them, the three trainings. Also in the bodhisattva path, certain of the six perfections are included in the higher training of morality. That would be generosity, morality, and patience in general. Concentration, the perfection of concentration is the higher training of concentration, and the perfection of wisdom is the higher training of wisdom for the bodhisattva path, and the perfection of enthusiastic perseverance covers all three, is included in all three, because you need perseverance, energy to persevere in all of those practices.